the solution. As you know, last week we had a preliminary exposition of the kind of conceptual framework we want to develop to see what are the problems of modernity faced by Muslims. And essentially, last week Dr. Subhash discussed some of the ideas of Al-Ghazali, which relate to the question of attitude towards fiqh and fuqaha. So this week we hope to take this discussion further, inshallah.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Azhar. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. So our discussion was supposed to be in three parts of a trilogy, but unfortunately, since I will be traveling next week, so we have to stop here and to short it to two sessions. So this will be the final one. And because of that, I have to summarize what I had in mind to say and to put it forward in a very concise form. As you know, the title of the talk was Religion and the Challenges of the Modern Time, or Challenges of Modernity. In order to tackle the challenges, we had to have a clear conception of two important things. Number one, religion itself, and number two, modernity, in order to come to the relationship between the two and the varieties of connection that they can have. Now, as far as religion is concerned, we had a fairly lengthy discussion last time, and what I presented basically was this, that religion, especially Islam, which is our model of religion, is a three-layered structure. At the core, you have got the experience, the religious experience, the esoteric experience, and then you have got two protective belts, which are like shells around a kernel. And the first protective belt is called ethics or morality, and the second is sharia or fiqh, the law. This is the structure of religion. Of course, in Judaism, more or less, you have got the same structure. But in Christianity, I call it a bare religion because the shell there is very thin, or perhaps next to nothing. And you don't have any shell, you have got the kernel, you have got the core. And of course, you have got a thin layer of morality, but no law virtually. And this absence of law is quite conscious. I mean, there is a philosophy behind it. It was not out of neglect or ignorance on the part of the pioneers or the prophet of that religion, but there was a philosophy behind it. And as you know, as far as Christianity itself is concerned, or perhaps the teachings of Christ according to Christians, he didn't like sharia, he didn't like law, and he thought that perhaps the written law is a cause of alienation, and so the law should be in heart rather than on paper, rather than in books, or to be imposed from above on people. So this legalism according to Christianity should be avoided. Anyway, there you have got a two-layered structure. But here, Islam, which has got a lot of similarities with Judaism and has taken a lot from Judaism in terms of law, we have got a three-layered structure. So this is our model of religion. And the model also applies to the two-layered structures, because there also what we say here can be applied, and no problem will arise anymore. So the protective belt is always needed. You have it and you must have it. Even in Buddhism, there you have got no deity, no divinity, as you know, but the religious experience is at the core, that you have got it. And of course, immorality is, originates out of the religious experience that you have got. That morality is not to be imposed from outside, but is to be, derived from within. And law also is absent there. You don't have any law there, and because of this, these people can live virtually under any government, under any culture, because they do not have any source of law whatsoever in religion. For Islam, of course, matters are very different. For Muslims, living under different laws, under different morality, is always a problem which needs a real challenge to solve. And that's why, especially in modern times, the challenge of modernity is massively felt by Muslims more than any other religion. So as far as the law is concerned, I think the challenges of modernity are very familiar and to some extent is easily solvable. I mean, for the people for whom religion is reduced or basically and mainly is presented in law, the challenge of modernity can be met very easily and sometimes very bravely, according to them. All you have to do is to go to fuqaha, to the experts on Sharia, and ask them different questions about how to live under a different culture, how to deal with other people from other religions, what is licit, what is illicit, what is halal and what is haram. And I think fuqaha are very active in this field, and they are very proud of it. And they think that they can solve all problems. And as I mentioned and alluded to last time, in Iran, actually, we have got the same situation. Now, fuqaha, of course, the people who are in rule, they are neither philosophers, nor ethicists, nor even commentators of Quran. I mean, their main expertise is fiqh, is Sharia. They are very well versed in this particular business. And because of this, I mean, their religiosity is mainly a law religiosity. It is not an ethical religiosity. It is not an experiential religiosity. It is a legal religiosity, which is very notorious, very conspicuous. And all they do is to, I mean, that is the main destination and the main purpose of their rule, in order to apply the laws of Sharia. And if I may quote Imam Khomeini, he said once, at the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, that all of our purpose will be ended when we apply the laws of Sharia. So the application of the laws of Sharia is the main purpose of the Islamic rule, according to the fuqaha in Iran. And that's why sometimes why they are so harsh on imposing the law on people. Now, for them, modernity is nothing but a bundle of legal questions. I mean, sometimes very sophisticated legally and sometimes very simple, but basically they are legal in nature. Even when you go to moon, as I said, travel to moon, so you have got there, a question, how to pray, where to pray to, and so they are busy solving these problems and answering these questions. Even I met, you see, a text from Jews that, these questions have been asked by Jews from their rabbis. And so, wherever you have got law, Sharia, you must be prepared to encounter, to face such questions and problems. So for legal religiosity, I would say, the challenge of modernity is well known and is supposed to be easily solvable. You have no problem. And, so there, mainly you ask what is halal and what is haram. I remember that once I was a member of a committee on the issue of development in Iran. I mean, some of our very well-educated colleagues, they actually set up this committee in order to discuss the issue of development, which is one of the most urgent issues in Iran. We as Muslims, how are we to deal with the business of development? I came to discover later that they were very legally minded, you see, and I reminded them of this. I told them once that you want us to tell you whether development is halal or haram. And that was really what they had got in mind. And I told them the answer is very easy and very simple. It is halal, it is not haram. You don't find any text in Islam, in Quran, in Hadith, whenever, to tell you that development is an impermissible, illicit thing. So you can go ahead and do whatever you would like to do. But you have to know that this is not the real problem there. One has to be keener in order to uncover the real problem hidden there. So whether television is halal or haram, this is a legal question, and you know, fuqaha will answer you very simply that, okay, it is halal, and go ahead. Whether computer is halal or haram, they really do not pay attention to the problems that the development creates for the modern life. That is not their problem. What they look at is this. Do we have any text to say that the use of this particular machine, for example, is halal or haram? And since, as you know, when we do not have any evidence as to the illicitness of something, we have to say that it is okay, permissible. So that is their business, and that's how they lead and guide their followers. So as far as legal religiosity is concerned, I mean, the problem is solved, I tell you. Or perhaps I should say, I promise you that no problem will remain unsolved. So sooner or later it will find its solution. So, period. But now let us come to the second layer of the structure. The second layer is the ethical or the moral layer. That is another protective belt around the core of the religious experience. This is more sensitive, more crucial, more important. And even from the point of view of religion itself, from the point of view of Islam itself, we have to take it more seriously. Because as you remember, I reminded you last time, it is the saying of the Prophet himself that وَبُعِثْتُ لِأُتَمِّمَ مَكَارِمَ الْأَخْلَاقِ. I am here in order to develop the morality. So roughly the hadith can be rendered like this. So that is the main purpose. He never said that I am here in order to apply legal rules. Mind you, I mean, one of the main followers of the Prophet in our time, when he comes to power, remember, he says it is our main purpose, namely Ayatollah Khomeini, to apply the rules of Islam. That is what he says explicitly. But when you listen to the Prophet himself, he never uses such a concept, and he never tells us this. He says that I am here in order perhaps to apply morality, to bring up a moral, an ethical nation, an ethical people. So developing morality is the main business of Islam, or the main mission of the Prophet of Islam. Therefore, and as I said, this is a protective belt, this is considered as a shell because it is a condition in which and through which you can have a religious experience. For immoral people, having contact or encounter with the supernatural, with the transcendental, is virtually impossible. Therefore, in order to be able to have such an encounter, you have to purify yourself. Therefore, purification, ethical purification, is prior to having the experience. So the ethical shell is on the one hand a protective belt, and on the other it is something which it is like an introduction, a channel which leads you and takes you to the core. So from both points of view you need it, and you have to keep it intact. So here we have got a moral religiosity, and here of course religiosity becomes more general in the sense that you have got a lot in common with other religions. Legal religiosity is good for differentiation, for stratification, in order to differentiate yourself, distinguish yourself from others, you must put your finger on the legal issues. I am this, you are that. I am, for example, I consider this as permissible and you consider it impermissible, and so on and so forth. So there you have got the disagreements, you have got the differences. But when it comes to morality, I mean, we have got a lot in common with other religions. I mean, look at Christians, look at Jews, and look at other religions. Even the non-religious people, in terms of morality, they are much closer to each other than in terms of law, of legal religious rules. This is important, very important. I have actually personally two experiences which I share you on this particular issue. One is older and the other one is younger. Let me begin with the younger one and then go to the older one. The younger one is this. When I was a student here, of course, and that was in early 70s, I did chemistry at first. So there was a seminar on chemistry in Cambridge, and I took part there, and my place was the flat of a student who was on holiday, so they gave us as a residence for a night or two. So I was searching the books of the student, of the main owner of the room. So I found a book, The Cloud of Unknowing. I just opened it and looked it up, a few pages, and I found the book so interesting that I don't remember, perhaps I couldn't sleep that night. And tomorrow I went, and anyway, I tried to find the book and found it and bought it. So it's now about 30 years that I am familiar with the book. I have read parts of it repeatedly, and well, I have got a long story with the book anyway. That was in Cambridge. Now, when I say that this story is younger, because now that I am living in Cambridge, but in the States, now I am translating the book. And so from Cambridge to Cambridge, that will be the title of the introduction that I am writing to the book. I am translating the book. Why I was fascinated and what interested me in the book was not, of course, the Christian dogma of the book. The book is written, let me give a very brief description of the book. It is a paperback book. It is by any standard, a very small book, about 150 pages, and it is written by an unknown author of 14th century Midland, England. So he was a contemplative, a man of esotericism, something, and nobody knows his name, and actually perhaps the title of the book is A Cloud of Unknowing. He wanted to be unknown, I mean, in accordance with the title of the book. So The Cloud of Unknowing by an unknown author. But the whole content of the book tells you that he was a priest, he was a contemplative, he was a solitary man perhaps, and he led a life of contemplation anyway. And this cloud of unknowing means a kind of a cloud between man and God. So we can never become gods, and we can never reach him or find him in this life, maybe in the next life. But it is our duty, according to him, to push hard through the cloud in order perhaps to make it thinner and to become closer to God through our worship, through contemplation and things like that. Now, the book is imbued and replete with Christian allusions to Bible and various different religious stories. So all these are besides the point. There, of course, we differ from Christians. And the difference is very conspicuous and very evident. So no Muslim actually quotes Bible at all, or perhaps does not believe in it, I mean. But the spirit, the essence of book is not Christian. It's something that I find it in Rumi, I find it in Ghazali, And that's actually what provoked me, perhaps, and induced me to translate the book, you see. And I'm going to write a whole footnote on the book, and quoting Rumi and Ghazali in order to show the commonalities between the Christian contemplation and esotericism and Islamic mysticism. You see, there are a lot in common. So when you come to the moral, layer of religiosity, and even when you go even deeper to the contemplative dimension of religion, you will find a lot in common. The second experience that I had was about Ghazali himself. I think I mentioned here last time that Ghazali wrote the Ihya ul-Ulum, of course, the revivification of religious sciences. So that was 900 years ago. And that was a very brave action on the part of him, because at that time, some people did not tolerate such an enterprise on the part of a conservative, perhaps, scholar. But he did it. It was a very influential book. And as I mentioned, there are some nasty allusions to Shiism, even in the book. But the book was well received by Shi'i community as well. Not because of the fiqh in the book. The book has got very lengthy sections on fiqh, on Sharia. Not because of that, but because of the moral issues that he has tackled in the book. In the 10th century, i.e. 500 years after the death of Ghazali, the book was edited by a Shi'i alim in the Safavid period. And the book now is in print in 8 volumes in Iran. Kashani has changed, has made a lot of changes on the part of Sharia in the book, and the section of Sharia. But virtually he has not touched the section on ethics and morality. Because there, Shi'is and Sunnis have got a lot in common, a lot in common. But as far as Sharia is concerned, of course, we differ sometimes, somehow. Even the way we pray is different, the way we make wuzu is different, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, it is like this. But when you go deeper, to the deeper layer, to the ethical, to the moral layer, there you find a lot of a lot in common, and the differences and disagreements vanish, or perhaps diminish. So this is the second layer, which is more important, and make us members of the same family, perhaps, make us closer to each other, whether within a particular religion or perhaps different religions. Now here, the challenge of modernity is more serious. Is more serious. Has to be taken more seriously. There are many things and many points which I can mention, but I think one thing is one or two. A couple of points perhaps are more important and more sensitive. At least nowadays people are more familiar with these two points. The idea of freedom and the idea of right, these two I will discuss consecutively, very briefly of course. Freedom is familiar, we know it. And as you know, the word, of course, has been always there. It is not a new fabrication, it is a new coinage. It has been always there. But the respect that people declare to freedom nowadays is much, much more than what it used to be in the past. And the pivotal place that it has now in morality, in ethics, in law, is very different from what it used to be. In the constitutional revolution in Iran, roughly 100 years ago, this particular concept was at issue. And there were ulama, I mean, on both sides, in both camps, people who did not like it and people who liked it. Okay. Now in the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we have got exactly the same problem, exactly the same debate going on in the press, among the ulama, among the intellectuals, and so on and so forth. Still, the problem is with us. And we have not moved an inch, I would say, from the position and the situation we were in 100 years ago. Still, we are discussing the problem that does Islam, I mean, accommodate freedom, or is it hostile to freedom? Is it a Western commodity? It is something which is ours, or perhaps we have to borrow it from foreigners, this and that, and you know, you are familiar. The problem is not yet solved. Problem is not yet solved. This means that now we have, a real problem there. And we have not been able so far to swallow it, to accommodate it, to incorporate it into the teachings of Islam. And we do not know how to deal with it, and to what extent it has to be accepted. Why is this? And where from freedom has, has borrowed such a respect and such a pivotal central place in the whole system of thought. As you know, freedom, of course, is part of justice. There is a false controversy, I would say, that is freedom prior to justice, or perhaps justice is prior to freedom. To me, this is a false discussion altogether. Freedom is a part of justice. I mean, when you apply justice fully, then you have to consider freedom as part of justice. So it is subsumed under justice. It is not something to be contrasted with it, or to be taken independently. It is dependent, and it is part of justice. If you want to do full justice to somebody, you have to respect his freedom. Okay. So whatever you mean by freedom anyway, because justice by far is the most general, the most universal ethical concept. All other moral ethical concepts come under it and can be subsumed under justice, including freedom. So this means, I would like, though this is in brackets, I am mentioning it, this means that the concept of justice, I mean, needs a better scrutiny, has to be analyzed more than ever. This means that even justice among us has not been done. I mean, we have not done justice, the full justice, to the concept of justice itself. And I have got a lot of evidence to this effect. I can show you that for centuries the idea of justice has been virtually abandoned and forgotten by our moral philosophers. They have never taken it anew in order to discuss it, in order to develop it. They have stopped where Aristotle stopped. The moral philosophy among Muslims, most unfortunately, is dependent on the moral concept of the old Greece. And they have followed, step by step, the Aristotelians, the Peripatetics, the Platonics, and so on and so forth. And, very seldom they have been able to add anything to the idea of justice. And because of that, not only the idea of freedom now seems so foreign to us, but also the idea of justice. And that's why nowadays, even among the Muslim scholars in Iran and elsewhere, to me, actually the idea of justice has to be taken first and to be developed and to be analyzed in order to come to the idea of freedom. Going directly to freedom will be a kind of shortcut and will take us nowhere. the idea of freedom itself is dependent on the idea of right. It is not an independent concept. I think I had a chance, I don't know, a year ago sometimes in Mahfil Ahli, some of you were there, to tell you that now, I mean, want it or not, we are living under a different paradigm. I mean, the Westerners, the Europeans, the modern man, anyway, is living under a new paradigm. I called it paradigm of rights, as opposed and in distinction with the paradigm of duties, which was the dominant and prevalent paradigm in the past. You know, all religions are the offsprings, are the products of the paradigm of duties. None, actually, at least the so-called heavenly or Abrahamic religions, none of them are, born under the paradigm of rights. The paradigm of rights is virtually, unknown at the time. The paradigm of rights is something that has replaced the paradigm of duties. The man who inhabits the world nowadays, according to this paradigm, is a rightful man, a rightful creature. But in the past, he was supposed to be a duty-bound creature. And these two characteristics are very, very essential. Very essential. I mean, the definition of man, the essential characteristic, the substantial form, to use some medieval conception, the substantial form of man, the definition of man according to the paradigm of rights is that he is a rightful creature. First,
right seeking.
Yes, you may say that. Yes, he is a rightful, a right-seeking person or creature, whereas in the past, as I said, his essential definition was that he is a duty-bound creature. So, rights means that you are independent. Let me remind you that the idea of the right is at least four centuries old. From the beginning of the Enlightenment, actually, we have got this. It was developed, it was in development. And until now, it's in full flower, one would say. It has got its own history. According to Locke, the rights has been bestowed upon human beings by God. Now, this is the middle way. We are no longer in that position. Now, according to Locke, we are not duty-bound creatures. We are right-seeking or rightful persons, but rights come from God. It does not stem from the nature of human beings. It is there. We have got them. We are carriers of rights. But this has been given to us, has been offered to us by an authority, namely God, somebody. This is the halfway. But when you proceed, when you move on from Locke to the modern time, this concept you will find is virtually abandoned. And the rights no longer come from any outside source. Rights are coming, or perhaps are stemming, from the very nature of human beings. We have got rights because we are human beings. It is with us. It is inalienable, according to them. It is like of a weight. It is like of a shape. It is like of a, blood structure and so on and so forth. So it is with us, and we need no other source in order to have them. We are justified in claiming rights. We are justified. Nobody has given us this justification. We are justified on the basis and by the virtue of being a human being. This is very, very important. Very important, because according again, I remind you that the ideas of right and duty are not new. The very concept is very, very old as the concept of justice, as old as the concept of virtue and vice and so on. So everybody knows that, and it is there in the literature of all nations. But the concept of inalienable right, stemming from the nature of human beings, this is the new conception, and this is the main pillar of the paradigm of rights. And from here, you need a very short move in order to reach the idea of freedom. So the idea of freedom means freedom to exercise one's rights. Freedom to exercise one's rights. So this is the main meaning of freedom in the modern age. In the past, you were a duty-bound, and according to religions, even now, you are a duty-bound creature. You are not free. You are free to perform your duties. You are not free to exercise whatever you think that is your right. So you are free. It means that you are obliged. It is actually incumbent upon you to perform your duties. And apart from your duties, you have virtually no place for maneuver. So, not only the idea of freedom stems from the idea of right, but also freedom here means freedom, the right to be free even from morality. Perhaps you have noticed this in the modern culture. You are free to be non-religious. You are free to be non-moral. Freedom from everything. Freedom from whatever that in the past was supposed to be a duty. You know, it is a duty according to religion to be religious. It is not a right to be religious. It is a duty to be religious. It is not a right to be moral. It is a duty to be moral. But for a rightful person, it is a right to be moral. You may or may not, use your right here, or enjoy your right. It is a right to be religious, and so on and so forth. So even freedom here has got a very special meaning. And this particular meaning of freedom is so repugnant, actually, to the religious mentality, that they cannot accommodate it. In a society such as ours, nobody would tolerate you to say that it is my right to be religious, it is my right to be Muslim. This means that it is my right to not to be a Muslim. So right can be taken either ways. It is my right to be moral, and so on and so forth. It is left to people to choose. It is left to people to opt for morality or immorality, and so on and so forth. It is left to people because it's their rights. But according to a duty paradigm, it is not left to you. You have to be moral. You have to be religious. You have to perform your duties, and so on and so forth. And because of this, the idea of law nowadays has become so prominent and so important in the modern time. Again, I have got my own experience in Iran. At the outset of the revolution, I was a member of another committee anywhere, and some of ulama also were members of that committee. The subject of the committee was this. Why? Exactly the question at issue was this. Why our people are so, heedless towards law? Why they do not bother about law? Why they do not take it so seriously? They do not obey the law, the civil law, not the religious law. There were a number of reasons, and causes discussed there. But the main thing is this, that as opposed and as distinct from societies in which law is taken very seriously and very important, and the court is very important, justice is very taken seriously, that is because you have loosened morality elsewhere. And because of that, you need law to be very strict. You have loosened morality. You have told people that you are free to be moral or immoral. You are free to be religious or non-religious. So it is left to you. And because of that, law has to be more powerful than elsewhere. Okay? So when you see that even law is taken so seriously in the modern time, you have to know that it is at the expense of morality. It is at the expense and at the cost of morality. They have sacrificed something in order to gain something else. This is the deal that has taken place. No, I am not saying that the modern man is necessarily immoral. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is this, that theoretically speaking, freedom means this. Of course, most of the people may opt for morality, but theoretically they are free. They can even select non-morality. Okay, immoral. They can. Maybe most of the people still choose to be religious, as in the States, for example. Nevertheless, theoretically they are free, and they can choose to be non-religious, immoral, and so on and so forth. So it is their right. So this is the meaning of the paradigm of rights. And you know that that clashes with the traditional religious teachings and the no reconciliation, no compatibility whatsoever is in the perspective. You cannot see it. And I think this is one of the important challenges of modernity to religious teachings. The idea of rights and the idea of freedom, both actually subsumed under the idea of justice. So I think in order to meet the challenge, I tell you and I confess here that I don't have any ready-made answer to the question. It is, too sophisticated, too complicated to be solved at one stroke. It needs a lot of it is really mind-consuming, and you have to put a lot, invest a lot on it in order perhaps to reach and to gain something. But anyway, what I'm going to put forward here is just to draw your attention to the challenge itself, to the severity of the challenge. That it is not only the question of halal and haram that we have got nowadays, and it is not only the fuqaha, the class of fuqaha, who are at stake, and perhaps who are the main sources to offer us the solution for the challenges. The challenges go much, much deeper than that. And the whole vision of man, of history, and everything has changed now. And one of the main changes that have developed is the change in the idea of the rights and the freedom of man. The question is this: can we base the idea of religion on the idea of rights? How are we to define the religiosity for the rightful man? So far, the task has been rather simple, to define religiosity for the duty-bound man. This has worked well so far, according to the tradition. In traditional societies, you have got on the one hand the religion, be it Christianity or whatever, and on the other hand, the vision of man of himself as a duty-bound creature. These two matched very well. And as I said, the main background for religions and the main the essential condition for their birth was this duty-bound paradigm. So these two went along, and no problem, no clash. But now we have got the clash. On the one hand, we would like to carry on with our religious teachings, which has got their roots in the duty-bound paradigm. On the other hand, the rightful man is born, not only in the western part of the planet, but virtually everywhere. People have become rights conscious. People have become rightful creatures. This is the vision that they have got from themselves. And to use a duty discourse for a man who considers himself as a rightful creature seems no longer working. So something has to be done here. Either we have to challenge the rights paradigm in order to go back to the duty paradigm, to perhaps show and demonstrate, to think of a new definition of religion, something, in order to make it compatible with the rights mentality. So that is the challenge. That is the challenge. Dictatorship under the banner of religion was a commonplace in the past. I mean, autocracy in the sense of a particular person having all powers at hand was a commonplace. And even it was acceptable. All people wanted from the ruler was to be just. And that was all. I mean, they asked the ruler to act, to behave justly, to judge justly. No person virtually actually questioned his power. All what's at stake was the justice of the ruler. But as you know, I mean, even nowadays, again, we have got experience of Iran and in other parts of the Islamic world, that people are not satisfied by an autocratic rule. I mean, the idea of the separation of power at least is accepted in the constitution of Iran. Okay? It has got no base, no root in religion, in Islam whatsoever. You cannot find even a single prophetic tradition telling you and teaching you that the power should be separated from each other. Nothing like that. Nor in Quran, neither in Quran, nor anywhere else in Hadith. But all ulama in Iran and elsewhere have actually submitted to it and had admitted it and had accepted it, because it is the the order of time, and this is something that you cannot deny it, you cannot overlook it, because everybody understands that it is something that is necessitated by justice. You have to accept it. So, as I said, the main challenge is like this. We have got a religiosity, an ethical religiosity, concomitant and accordant, if you like, with the duty-bound paradigm. Now, perhaps, we have to, try perhaps to redefine religiosity, or redefine it, in order to make it acceptable or at home with the rightful person at the time. If we do this, of course, the idea of freedom, of justice, and all this will find their solutions. Now, as to the core of religion, of religious experience, there also we have got a problem. This is going to be my last point. There also we have got a problem. Mystical religion in the past was a respectable dimension of religion. As actually I mentioned last time, prophets started off with experience and then they had That was the core and the kernel, and then they had those protective belts around the core. We followers actually have got a reverse movement. We start from the shell, perhaps in order to reach the kernel. Sometimes we do not reach. But that is the main destination, actually. So that is the criterion of religiosity, as I said. I mean, the prevalence of fiqh or sharia is no criterion whatsoever, because that can be imposed. And people may not be willing to perform it, but they have to, under an imposing rule. Morality, if it is detached from the religious experience, it is a secular morality. You cannot call it a religious morality. I mean, you can be a good person. You may tell the truth and all of that, but not because of for the sake of God. Not because of the fear of hell or something, but because you consider it, you deem it as the right action. So, civil or secular morality, in appearance, is very similar to religious morality, but the intention of the agent, of the person, and the purpose of the action is very different in two different, paradigms, religious paradigm and secular paradigm. In secular paradigm, you have got good and bad. You have got vice and virtue. But this vice and virtue only serves your mundane life. Nothing more than that. Serves your mundane life. But in a religious paradigm, of course, this good and bad has got far-reaching effects. Their consequences are very different. And even the goodness or the badness of action comes from elsewhere. Evidently, and according to at least the majority of the theologians, Muslim theologians, that comes from religion itself. Something which is bad, or something which is good, an action. So you wouldn't know it's vice or virtue independent of religion. You have to go to the teaching of religion. And also, you will be rewarded if you think that you are acting according to the order that you have been given. Not because your reason tells you that this is good or that is bad. So secular morality, one has to be very careful, is very different from the religious morality in core, in intention, and in purpose. So, as far as the religious experience is concerned, we need not only morality, purification of oneself, but also we need a kind of religious morality, a religious based purification, in order to prepare you for having a religious experience. In the modern time, some of the religious scholars have claimed that unfortunately religious experience has diminished, and this is something which is denied to the modern man, whereas the man who used to live in the past, they had more access towards this very sublime experience of mankind. I am not sure of that. I am not really sure of that, but what one has to have in mind is this, that it is the duty of the leaders, of the masses, because most of the masses, most of the leaders are themselves ignorant of such an important part of religiosity. They do not have the experience themselves. Sometimes they do not even believe in it. The more you are engaged in worldly affairs, the furthest you will be from religious experience. Therefore, in order to have a religious society, a religious milieu, you have to offer people a kind of freedom, a kind of disengagement with the world affairs, in order to make them ready to, as I said, to encounter the transcendental. This means really, I mean, I am not talking metaphysics. What I'm saying is very mundane, very down to earth. This means that if you are really busy with earning your life too much, if the government does not provide you the necessary conditions in order to live a normal life, then actually the society will become irreligious, because people have no chance whatsoever, no serenity, no opportunity to have that sublime encounter that I said. Dictatorships nowadays are like this. Poverty in our age is like this. That really does not leave people to think about things which are more important than the mundane life. So for the experiential religiosity, what we need is a normal society ruled by normal people, making provision, life provision for people, making life easier. And then that is the duty of the religious leaders in order to lead people towards the core of the religion. I think this brings me to the end, and the rest will be left to the respectable audience in order to put forward their observations, and some of the points which I only alluded to may be elaborated in the discussion. Okay, so thank you very much.